From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, classroom pizza parties, prizes, picture days. It's count day in Michigan schools.
People wonder why is Michigan in such dire straits financially as far as schools go and educationally, because we don't do what the winners are doing.
Generation Startup, a new film, tracks new college grads trying to build startups in a Detroit recovering from bankruptcy.
For them, building companies, moving to Detroit, you know, what they're doing is not, I mean, for none of them, it was ever about money. It really is about doing something bigger than themselves.
And why is it so hard to hop on a bike and get across the border to Canada?
We would like to be able to go from downtown Detroit to downtown Windsor with our bikes or walking.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, new college grads trying to build startups in Detroit.
Finding their way as people, first jobs out of college, I'm really clueless in many ways, as we all are when we come out of college, and just diving in and taking risks in a way that most of their generation aren't.
But first, today is count day, the day when every student sitting at his or her desk means state dollars for that district. Across the state, schools are using a variety of tactics to ensure maximum attendance, from robocalling parents to picture days to prizes for kids who turn up. With us now is Chastity Pratt Dawsey, education writer for Bridge Magazine. Just how important is Count Day for Michigan schools?
It is the day. The majority of state funding is going to be determined on today's count. And a little bit from last spring. You mix those two numbers together, you have the per pupil allotment. That's the day, today. So really, it counts more if you're in a district that is struggling with enrollment, or if you're in a district that is looking at potential deficit, might be on the fence on the border. These are the districts that cannot afford to lose students. So they definitely want as many students as they can get to be in the classroom today.
Chastity, is this as important for charter schools as for public?
Absolutely. And in some charter schools, probably even more so. You're talking about schools that are not able to get capital improvement millages. You're talking about charter schools that, you know, they're losing students as well. So, and also charter schools don't have as much funding as some of our districts across the state. You don't have any hold harmless charter schools getting 12, 10, 15,000 or whatever thousand per student. So it's very important for charter schools because their funding formula is a little bit different from other public schools. And they're, again, losing students in some of our urban areas where they're really concentrated.
So what happens, Chastity, if today's headcount isn't what the district was expecting or hoping for?
In a city like Detroit that is still on the precipice of solvency, of, you know, not being in deficit, it is very important. Every student lost, every student that, you know, you don't get, that you anticipated in your budget having, that's less money that the state is going to be giving you starting this month, starting in October, I believe. And so what happens is you have to start cutting if you don't get as many students, if you don't get as much funding as you anticipated. So it's really crucial.
So here we see districts have to operate with less money. So you lay off staff, you cut programs, you try to consolidate and streamline, which, of course, diminishes the end product, so parents send their kids elsewhere, and that downward spiral will continue.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and this is the legacy of Proposal A, which, of course, as you know, is our state school aid funding formula. And, you know, we do this in Michigan differently than other states. You know, people wonder why is Michigan in such dire straits financially as far as schools go and educationally, because we don't do what the winners are doing. Look at the gold standard, Massachusetts. If you lose students there, there's a formula. You're not going to lose all of that money that student would have brought in that one year. It's a gradual process for, you know, weaning you off of that state aid when your enrollment is declining. Even in Ohio, they say, okay, we're going to have a funding system that's based partly upon the wealth of the district that you're living in. And when you lose students, you know, there's like a gradual step down process. And so Michigan, you lose a student, that's $8,000, or in the case of Detroit, $7,600 you're not going to get straight away. And it can be, it can really put districts in dire straits when they're trying to say, okay, now that we don't have those students, what do we do? You're cutting as you're educating.
Yeah. And in fact, as we talked to a couple of very frustrated school board folks who are stepping down, had enough, who said, how are you supposed to be planning your budget for the year when, as you say, they could wind up losing money, you know, next month?
Exactly. And so it's a guessing game for a lot of these districts saying, okay, next year's budget, we think we'll have, and like in Detroit, we think we'll have 45,000 students. And here you go on count day, and if they don't make that number, bam, you got to start cutting immediately. Whereas in other states, they say, okay, you didn't make your number, we'll gradually wean you off this money. We won't snatch it all away at once. It's a really tough situation for districts. And even some of our wealthier districts are seeing enrollment declines. These districts might have a little money in the bank, so they can take it a little better. But urban districts, districts where, you know, they're on the fence, it's a blow. And so that's why you see in some of these urban districts, in districts that don't have as much money and are losing enrollment, they do these little enticements to get kids to come to school on count day.
Begging parents.
Oh, please, there's pizza parties, there's, you don't have to wear your uniform today, just come to school. And, you know, the enticement should be a quality education. But a lot of these districts cannot afford some of the educational quality enticements, such as, you know, reading tutors, or such as advanced placement or IB classes. So they have to resort to come to school, and we'll have giveaways today.
You know, I think, Chastity, school funding, it's one of those issues that doesn't really make it onto your radar screen until you have kids going to school. So taking us back to 1994 with Proposal A, what was the reason for that, and what did it do that has put the schools of, you know, being on bended knee today on count day?
What it did is it totally redid how we fund schools. It added 2 cents to the sales tax, which gives us our current 6% sales tax, and it allowed property owners across the state to get a property tax cut because, you know, now we're going to get most of the funding from sales tax. However, of course, as we know, when, you know, there's a bad economy, or, you know, we don't get as much as we anticipated in sales taxes, the schools are going to take a hit. So that's one bad thing. But the other point of Proposal A was to try and close the gap between low-funded districts and higher-funded districts. The gap has closed some in the 22 years or so, but in order for a district such as Detroit to catch up to a wealthy district like Birmingham, for instance, my kids' kids will be in school before that happens. You know, it's an $8,000 or like $5,000 difference there. So it was supposed to give taxpayers a break, and it was also, or property taxpayers a break, also supposed to close the gap. And the problem is, at the same time, a couple years later, we had charter schools, we had schools of choice, we had what is commonly referred to as free market schools of choice, let people pick where they want to go to school, and a lot of kids moving in, moving out, enrollment started to go up and down and move all around, and made it really hard for public school districts to project their enrollment with kids coming and going and, you know, districts trading students. That's really what puts some of these districts on bended knee. They don't know from year to year exactly how many kids they're going to have.
Now, have there been any moves towards trying to correct some of these problems that have come from Proposal A?
Well, there's been an effort in Lansing to try and figure out how much should Michigan be paying to provide an adequate education. They called it the adequacy study, because right now what we're doing is we're paying schools what we think we can afford in Michigan, not necessarily basing it on what an education should cost. So this adequacy study that was done by the legislature, or approved by the legislature, said, look, Michigan needs to be paying about $8,300 per pupil. for, and right now, you know, there are districts getting 7,200, 7,600. And there are some that are getting 10, 11, like a couple dozen that are getting far, far more. But the adequacy study said at least 8,300. And now the next step would be for the legislators and the governor and all the educators to get on the same accord and say, okay, do we believe that this study is true? We need $8,300 minimum. And if so, how do we get there? That's the next step. However, that's a huge lift. That's totally redoing our system. That's doing a Massachusetts-level reform. And so far, we've not seen the political will for that.
And parents, really, it seems as if they're stuck on the sidelines, unable to really influence it. Or can they? Is there anything parents who care and understand this situation can do to help their districts?
We always like to think that parents and voters are the, you know, most influential people in the state. So, but the problem is this is such heady, complicated stuff, you know, to get a movement behind changing the formula for schools and improving the, you know, just the funding structure is hard stuff. It's hard to understand and it's hard to do. And it's going to take someone really, some good leadership, probably out of Lansing, and maybe even the unions being involved to get everyone on the same page. But parents, once there is a clear way forward, I mean, property tax owners were the ones who said, give me property tax relief, and therefore we got Proposal A. So, yeah, regular folks can move this.
Chastity Pratt-Dossie, Bridge Magazine. As always, Chastity, thank you so much.
Anytime.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What is the barrier between you and the life you truly want to lead? That's the question Cheryl Miller Hauser explores as co-director of a new documentary film, Generation Startup. It follows some young entrepreneurs as they build startups in Detroit. They try, stumble, learn from the school of hard knocks, and then try again. You come away with a much deeper appreciation for the struggle and passion that goes into building your own business. And these stories reflect the way Detroit is fighting its way back from its historic bankruptcy. Cheryl Miller Hauser is co-director of this film, Generation Startup. Cheryl, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me, Cynthia.
Glad to have you. I love this documentary. And it, as you focus on recent college grads, tell us why you and co-director Cynthia Wade felt it was very important to shine a light on these 20-somethings.
Sure. So my son is a fellow, or was a fellow, in a program called Venture for America, and Venture for America recruits recent college graduates from around the country and places them with startups in 15 cities across the country to train as entrepreneurs and then help them launch companies. So I was watching the life-changing experience my son was having, being thrown into the deep end, employee number 11 of a startup in Providence. And I approached the founder of Venture for America, Andrew Yang, and said, I would like to follow some of your fellows, this entrepreneurial journey in one of the cities. And he was on board. And I then attached Cynthia as my co-director, really wonderful director. And Cynthia and I had to go about figuring out which of these 15 cities were we going to pick to follow these young people launching companies. And there's really exciting things happening all over the country, but nothing like Detroit. So we were just, and when we started the movie, it was, we started filming in July of 2014. So Detroit was still in bankruptcy in a very different city than it is now. So as we tracked our entrepreneurs' personal journeys, we were also tracking the change going on in Detroit.
Yeah, Detroit truly is a character in this film, just as much as all of these hardworking young people.
Absolutely. And people from Detroit who have seen the movie, they come away feeling really happy that we were able to capture the grit, the resilience, the hopefulness that Detroit hustles harder, the entrepreneurial spirit of that city.
Just kind of give us a sense of who these young people are and some of the businesses that they're trying to build.
Sure. So we have Max Nussenbaum, who came to Detroit in 2012, worked for a startup there for 2 years. He and a few friends bought a house at auction for $8,200, and they were completely clueless about how to renovate a house, but they, you know, dove in. and through that experience decided they wanted to launch a company together. So their company is Castle Property Management, so using technology to automate property management. Brian Rudolph had a gluten intolerance and wanted to find a healthy pasta, and he started playing around with chickpea pasta in his kitchen and developed Bonza, the first ever chickpea pasta. So those are the two companies we follow launching. And then Labib, who comes in and works for Mason, which is a company that develops smartphones and tablets, and Dextina Booker, who's working when she arrived for Rock Ventures, and Kate Catlin, who works at Detroit Lab. But they're all, you know, 22 to 24-year-olds, some of them right out of college, really just finding their way as people, first jobs out of college, really clueless in many ways, as we all are when we come out of college, and just diving in and taking risks in a way that most of their generation aren't. Millennials are the kids coming out of college now, the most risk-averse generation in decades.
It's amazing, isn't it, how much they fear failing. I'm a mom. I'm familiar with this. That idea of having to leave that cocoon of college scares
right.
them, and then stepping out into the world. And you really do see these young, all of these young entrepreneurs get their noses bloodied through the course of your film.
I think that's something you definitely, and because we followed some of them for 17 months, it's a real longitudinal study in the trenches with them. I mean, it's a real follow doc, it's not a talking head film. We're with them as they're stumbling and failing. And we also gave them all GoPros. So they filmed themselves in very vulnerable moments, which often, you know, provides a lot of the humor and also, you know, really, really an insider look at that emotional journey of, you know, coming of age and also launching a company, which is a really scary thing to do. And I think even, you know, maybe scarier when you're that young and you really have not had a ton of experience and you're learning every day as you go. But they are all super uncomfortable in these roles they've taken on because they're so in over their heads. And yet they learn to be comfortable in that discomfort. And, you know, more than anything, I think that the film traces their human growth. And they all, at the end, realize that, you know, for them, building companies, moving to Detroit, you know, what they're doing is not, I mean, for none of them, it was ever about money. It really is about doing something bigger than themselves.
We're going to take a listen to a bit of a clip from Generation Startup, and this is about just a wonderful young woman named Dextina Booker, who today works for Shinola, so we know she's still in Detroit. And she came in as a Venture for America fellow, working what, for Rock Ventures?
Yes. She started out working for Rock Ventures, but she went to MIT. She graduated with a degree in mechanical engineering and really, really missed engineering. So now she is working as a mechanical engineer for Shinola Audio and really loving, you know, applying her engineering expertise.
So I'm still trying to figure out, like, if I'm ever going to hit my stride and feel like I'm fully competent at what I'm doing.
Yeah. The nature of what we do is extremely project-based.
Right.
So you'll hit your stride in a certain project, and then a project ends, and you're like, crap, I'm on to the next project, and now I feel again like I don't know what I'm doing. But it's part of the cool pieces about being here, to know that you play a piece in the ecosystem.
That's a clip from Generation Startup, co-directed by my guest, Cheryl Miller Hauser. And Cheryl, you say this film really is not just about entrepreneurship, and you're looking ahead and asking questions really about the future of young companies and future jobs in this country. So how important are these young people to our economic future?
They're hugely important. Entrepreneurship is at a 25-year low. People think we're in this golden age, but we're not. And young companies create two-thirds of all new jobs. So if we don't have new companies being formed, then we're at a standstill in terms of job creation. So it really is critical. Just like entrepreneurship and innovation were the drivers that made Detroit such an amazing city a century ago, it is entrepreneurship and innovation that is driving its renaissance now.
You know, even for those of us who are not of an entrepreneurial mind, you learn so much as you watch what it takes. I mean, I think of Brian Rudolph and Avery Hairston from Bonza, and you look at them and you ask, why do you care so much about making pasta out of chickpeas? And they're asking themselves the same questions, but then we all learn together what that passion is all about.
I think it's two things. It's one, the passion, for sure, and they're all super passionate. And secondly, I think it's slightly the, like, naivete or the blindness, which, you know, or with Max and his friends in with the house, you know, Max says, if we had known what we were getting ourselves into, we would never have done it. But, like, with anything like this, you have to go in a little bit blind. Otherwise, you know, you wouldn't have the guts to do it.
What do you hope audiences will get out of watching Generation Startup?
I hope that our characters in Generation Startup will inspire people across the country to step outside their comfort zone, to take risks in even small ways. I think that a lot of us, and I know that I have been guilty of this, we're held back by a fear of failing, fear of, you know, making a fool of ourselves. And I think that by seeing these kids, and they do fail, they fail and fail and fail until they figure it out, and then they soar. And that is the only way that we learn and grow. And then the second thing I hope people will take away from the film is what's going on in Detroit. I mean, the people have seen the film so far who are not from Detroit. They come away and they say, oh, my God, I didn't realize what was going on there. Like, what an incredible place. I've got to get myself to Detroit, or I want to move to Detroit. So I'm really excited about this spotlight we're putting on Detroit as well. And the entrepreneurial spirit that we've captured in our kids, but that's really prevalent throughout the city and the incredible entrepreneurs well beyond our kids who are in Detroit.
Generation Startup will be screened on Friday, October 7th at 7 p.m. at the Detroit Institute of Arts in Detroit. You can get all kinds of information by going to their website, generationstartupthefilm.com. Cheryl Miller-Hauser, co-director, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, we're opening at the DIA October 7th, so we hope everyone comes out to see the film.
As more and more people turn to bicycles for transportation, fun, and fitness, one might think it would be great to be able to bike between Detroit and Windsor. Well, once upon a time that could happen, but no more. Cyclists on social media write of the days when they could ride, even walk across the Ambassador Bridge from Detroit to Windsor and back. But after Maddie Maroon bought the Ambassador Bridge, the bike and pedestrian walkway was replaced by wider lanes to better handle 18-wheelers. So what's left, and what's needed to improve prospects for cross-border biking in Detroit and Windsor? We turn to a couple of veterans of the cycling scene in both cities. Lori Newton is the executive director of Bike Windsor Essex. Hello, Lori.
Hello.
And Dave Sands is a journalist for Modeshift. He was formerly with the Huffington Post, and Dave has been covering cross-border biking issues for some years now. Hi, Dave.
Howdy, Cynthia.
Good to have you both with us. Dave, let's say I am planning a cycling trip around Lake Erie. What happens when I wheel into Detroit and I'm ready to cross into Windsor?
Well, it's pretty difficult to get across. You know, I was speaking to a Windsor cyclist who was at a slow roll event a while back, and he said to cross, it's difficult. You either have to pack up your bike in your car or ride a bus through the Windsor Tunnel, but then you have to have it disassembled in a bike bag. So it's not the easiest of tasks. You don't just whisk across.
And I think a lot of people are surprised to know that until you think about it and go, well, yeah, I mean, I've been on the Ambassador Bridge and, you know, trucks and cars only, and certainly not through the tunnel. Lori, what about ferry services?
Well, it's a dream at this point, but we're really looking forward to promoting and having at least a pilot project for a ferry to come over. We would like to be able to go from downtown Detroit to downtown Windsor with our bikes or walking, rekindle that historic connection that our two cities have had.
When I was reading some comments amongst the cycling community, and somebody wrote, well, yeah, if you want to take a ferry, you can go up to Algonac or Marine City.
That's right.
That is stunning. Lori, what about the take from Windsor's biking community? What would it be like for folks to have that clear pathway to get to and from Windsor and Detroit?
It would have a tremendous impact on our community. We would be very excited to have an opportunity to ride our bikes across on a ferry. Right now, we have an awful lot of Windsor cyclists and Essex County cyclists who are very excited to go over and participate in the Monday night slow rolls. To do that, we have to put our bicycles on our cars, so you need the rack, you need the bike on the car, and of course, many of us have a two-bicycle rack. It's very, very difficult to get any more than a couple of people over at a time, so you end up with convoys of cars crossing the border to go not very far, and if we had a ferry, of course, we could just get downtown Windsor and cross over for that Monday night ride. That would be fantastic, and honestly, when we have out-of-town guests coming from anywhere, from Europe or across Ontario or Canada, one of the main things that everyone wants to do is to go and explore Detroit. And Detroit has moved so far forward with fantastic cycling infrastructure, all those big wide roads that have lent themselves to creating bike lanes and even some protected bike lanes. It's an opportunity for us to go and explore a new country, and we would like to see the same back and forth. We have our wineries out in the county, and then to be able to invite Detroiters over on their bicycles or people from beyond Detroit to come over and explore our wineries, that would be pretty fantastic.
Dave Sands, do you think there is enough potential business from cyclists and walkers to financially support a ferry?
I think so. There's a ton of interest, national attention on Detroit. The city's building what's called an inner circle greenway, which is this big sort of loop around the center of the city that people can travel through. And I hear there's something similar happening in Windsor. So if there was a way to create a cross, you could do a big figure eight between both cities. So lots and lots of interest and lots of cyclists. You see them with slow roll. There's like thousands and thousands of people who come here. So, yeah, I think there's interest, and I hear about it from folks in the community.
And I know, Laura, you mentioned this pilot idea. What's that about? Who's involved? And what would it take to make it happen?
The American side, some of the cycling groups over there have mentioned that they would love to maybe coordinate a pilot of the ferry for our Open Streets Day, and we could have the first truly international Open Streets event where we would have Open Streets in Detroit and Open Streets in Windsor, and we could cross and go back and forth. I mean, that would be fantastic. But also, we're looking at some pretty significant rides that take place across the trails, the broader trails right down to Ohio and up through Ontario, even to Quebec. Our Quebec cycling routes are known across the world, really, for 5,000 kilometers that you can travel. There are a lot of long-distance cyclists who want to do some major rides, and they want to cross here so that they can access that trail and continue up further north. So the opportunities are really quite amazing. I recently rode the Five Borough Ride in New York. 35,000 people show up for that ride. So with 5,000 people showing up at the slow roll in Detroit and hundreds on the Windsor side for other rides, we have so much potential here. And of course, given our climate and given the flatness of our land, we are just filled with opportunity for what we could do with cycling. It would be a draw and a magnet across North America for certain.
David, it's many, many years from being done, but what are the prospects for being able to cycle or walk on the Gordie Howe Bridge?
Well, I spoke with a representative from the Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority, which is the Canadian agency that's overseeing the bridge, back in May. And they said that they had schematics in place, blueprints for that possibility, and I think they kind of said they were interested, but they're still in the bidding process. But I do know that, you know, in the last couple months, a bunch of different organizations, including, you know, City of Detroit, Windsor, the Canadian Consulate, local bike groups like the Detroit Greenways Coalition, basically produced a map that had different routes that you could go from across both sides of the border. So I think that there's a lot of political will to get it done, and I know that the authority is considering. It's just we don't know yet, and I can't see anything definitive at this point. But there's a lot of interest, and there's a lot of a push for it.
Now, we are certainly living in an age where there's far more scrutiny of our respective borders than there used to be. What kinds of safety and security issues would need to be addressed? Let's say, for example, Laurie, as you talk about this pilot ferry that there's hopes to see in September, what kind of safety and border issues have to be addressed?
Well, people have to go through customs, although this is nothing new. We have border crossings for cyclists and pedestrians in Niagara, at Gananoque, and at other areas. There are a number of options that the customs people could put into place. Again, it comes down to the will of those who are looking at budget items and seeing that there is a true potential for this opportunity. We're looking at the bridge as well, where the bridge lane would not be something that my grandmother would get out on a Sunday afternoon and go ride. It'll be a destination ride, I think, for people to come and ride that. And you will have to have some sort of customs at the other end, but how complex that needs to be is yet to be seen. I've gone through both Niagara and Gananoque, and it's not a very complicated process. You have your ID on you, and you go through. Of course, in this region, we're very, very accustomed to crossing. So cyclists would have to have the same as would pedestrians. And there also would have to be some safety for a bridge crossing where people couldn't inadvertently find themselves riding with traffic or falling off the bridge. But again, those are engineering issues and customs issues that would be dealt with.
I was just in San Francisco and went across the Golden Gate Bridge and saw them.
Yeah.
And so we certainly know that can all be engineered. Well, it certainly is a vision worth pursuing, and hopefully it will come together. And it'll be interesting to see if you can get that pilot ferry up and going in September and maybe convince somebody there's a business opportunity. Lori Newton is executive director of Bike Windsor Essex, and Dave Sands is a journalist for Modeshift. Dave joined us via Skype. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Over the past few months, some highly profitable radio and TV stations in Southeast Michigan have been letting go some of their best talent. Why is that? Some may argue it's a ripple effect of an action by the FCC during the Clinton administration, the Telecommunications Act of 1996. 20 years out, here we are. Many long-standing rules, like a person or company only being allowed to own one station per market, were scrapped. Supporters argued the new rules would spark competition and thereby create growth and new jobs. Have we really seen that happen in the 20 years? Let's talk about that now as we welcome Amanda Lotz, professor of communication studies at the University of Michigan. Good to have you back on the program, Amanda.
I'm glad to be here, Cynthia.
And we welcome Dick Kernan, a 50-some-year veteran of the Detroit radio scene. He's the vice president of industry relations at the Spex Howard School of Media Arts. Good to see my old friend.
And by the way, you were 10 years short.
Are we up to 60 now?
July.
60. Time flies when you're having fun. Yeah, there we go.
I got no complaints.
And we'll talk about why it's no longer the Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts as it was. So that's kind of part of what we're going to talk about. Let's start with, Amanda, just what is the Telecommunications Act of 1996 and why did it come to be?
Well, it's the most recent wide-ranging form of regulation for the broadcast television and radio industries in the United States. And in many ways, it was an update. Really, the founding documents go back to about 1934. In many ways, a lot of our regulation is still built on that 1934 Act. And the 96 Act was an aim to update, certainly a much different technological environment, one that included cable, increasingly satellite television. And I think the really important part of looking at the 96 Act right now is remembering that it came to be on the cusp of broadband. There was definitely a sense that this new technology was coming, but there was also a lot of uncertainty. And I think the world that we have here 20 years later was certainly not imagined and not anticipated by the legislation.
Oh, boy.
Was it welcomed by the industry?
Some parts. For the big radio conglomerates and the big television ones as well, it allowed them to become much larger than they had been in the past. So there had been different regulations that were geared to try to keep all forms of broadcasting local and to encourage a diversity of voices. And many of those regulations came off. Specifically for radio, all of a sudden it became possible to own as many radio stations as you wanted nationwide. And we went very quickly from a big radio station group having maybe 20 to 30 stations to Clear Channel at 1,200. The makeup of the national radio business changed tremendously. On the television side, the limits weren't taken off completely, although the expectation was very much that in 98 or 2000, that the FCC would begin loosening those. And by that point, I think the response to what had happened in radio was so significant that there was a lot more public attention. And as a result, the FCC didn't lift those television caps in the same way.
Dick Kernan, as this was enacted in 96, what was the feeling in the trenches in local radio and TV stations?
I don't think anybody had any idea how this would turn out. The other thing that happened is the unfortunate recession that followed fairly closely after that.
Within the decade.
Well, the nice thing about this was the fact that you can buy them with very little tax problems. And so they said, hey, we'll take it. And so that's how Clear Channel got all these stations.
In fact, let's back up. For people listening, because we've got people listening all over Michigan who may not, when we say Clear Channel, those of us in the business certainly mm-hmm. know. So give us an idea of what Clear Channel has become because of having the restrictions lifted through this act.
It's become this gargantuan. They own somewhere, 800, 900 stations?
At a peak, they were at 1,200.
The problem with that is that when the economy started to sort of go away, they found themselves... Their debt today, it's called iHeart today. I have another word for it, but I won't use it on the radio.
All right.
Rhymes with heart. anyway, what it does is all of a sudden you're in debt up to here, and so you have to cut your expenses. And the easiest way to cut expenses is to let people go. And I thought we had finished that little thing, but it's still going on. You know, CBS was just an incredible radio group. Their stations were incredibly popular. Leslie Moonves has decided radio's dead, so he wanted to sell them. The problem is no one can afford to buy them. And so what he's done is he's announced that the radio division will be a separate company, and they'll just take CBS out of the mix. They'll retain control, but it will be a separate company from the big CBS.
Mm-hmm.
This has been going on now for a long time. You know, I'm looking at an example.
Yes, as we were part of that, you're right. And when I started in my career, it was 1979, 1980. And I remember the stations that I worked for were family-owned, Crawford Broadcasting. Mm-hmm. When I started in television, was Cox, the Cox family, Cox Broadcasting. And your competition was really your competition, and you would never dare mention a name or, you know, you were focused on winning. And then by the 2000s, when I worked for Greater Media, our competition, there were three of us in the one building. We were all getting coffee together. They were our coworkers. And it still is weird for me to wrap my mind around hearing one station say, and our sister station on da-da-da-da. It's against everything that I learned when I started. But it shows how different things are. And then also when you have a huge group like Clear Channel or iHeart Radio, you can say, cut, 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 heads can roll. And by the way, we'll have one DJ tracking for all kinds of stations. So I'm interested, Amanda, how has that changed the national landscape? We know that stations are licensed to serve the public. Is this serving the public?
I think we can debate whether or not the FCC has ever even had the resources to really evaluate that. Hmm. And licenses, I think part of Telecom Act of 96 as well, was an extension in licensing periods. At this point, polling licenses is so rare. And I think you also have a population that isn't really geared to think about radio and television stations, aware of their commitments in order to hold them accountable. So I think we've got potentially policy failures on multiple levels. You have a population that doesn't know what to expect, and you have a regulatory agency that at this point is charged with so much and that has never really been able to pay attention to what stations were actually doing on the ground, except for, you know, a rare case of extreme abuse when a population did protest.
Or something happened like a Super Bowl Justin Timberlake, Janet Jackson moment that gets the FCC's attention and fines.
Exactly. To understand what has happened, and from a business standpoint, the idea was that there were these advantages to be gained in economies of scale. Instead of, you know, just having the top 40 station in Detroit, if you also own the top 40 station in Ann Arbor and Grand Rapids, you could effectively run them all pretty similarly. And that's really what has happened. In many cases, you have playlists that are nationally distributed instead of, I mean, those are where all those jobs have gone, where stations used to be fully staffed operating on their own. Now you have one person doing that job for a multitude of stations that may be in the same building, maybe in the same state, it may be nationwide.
And with the change in the landscape, Dick, Fortune magazine came out with its worst jobs in America list based on environment, income, outlook, and stress. Number one, newspaper reporter. Number three is broadcaster. And number four is disc jockey. Does that stem from this Telecommunications Act of 96?
Of course.
And how so?
Because you have to cut staff. And one of the best ways to cut staff is to have a certain small number of people who, in addition to being live on the air and saying almost nothing, are also doing exactly the same thing for two or three stations in Arizona or wherever. And so the need for those people has diminished fairly significantly. What's made up for it is all of the other jobs that now, and again, I'm going to use, you know, there is a company which you're familiar with, who do just great stuff. They still do radio. It's just so amazing to listen to what they do. They're live most of the time, and they do just a lot of things that radio traditionally did that rely on live human beings to do them. The other thing is that you don't have these situations in a lot of other places. One of the things that has become clear to me over the past umpteen years is what a great life you can have in small markets. Station up in Howell, Michigan, okay? Everyone there, 85% of their air staff are grads, including the program director And you can't go anyplace in Livingston County and not see these guys out there with their vans and stuff like that.
So it's existing in the small markets.
Well, and let me give you a great example. Yeah. 2 years ago, I was in Traverse City for a conference and spent time with two of our graduates. One is the program director of the rock station up there, mm-hmm. and she also does an air shift. And the other guy is the morning guy at the country station. They both celebrated, and this is 2 years ago, 30 years.
So if we dig down and get into these smaller markets, Amanda, are we still seeing the kind of broadcasting that existed where it was responsive to local needs, where local news is important and is covered?
I think it's really difficult to generalize. The general rap is that once you have this kind of conglomeration, that the local tastes and local preferences tend to get eliminated in the process. But I think we can also point to different station groups that do maintain, either with some or a multitude of their stations, some sort of local commitment. I think the example that I think of here in Ann Arbor, 107.1 is a Cumulus station. You hear that in their description, which means they too are owned by one of these giant companies. Their playlist, I think, is coming out of Atlanta. But they do maintain some, especially on the weekend, local shows and a commitment to the community. And I think the other piece that's important is the way that a lot of broadcasters have been part of the community, whether sponsoring sports teams or sponsoring mm-hmm. fund drives and things like that. I don't think it's helpful to sort of paint with a broad brush, yes. sort of saying that conglomeration always does this. I think we have to understand the business strategies that are behind them. And in order to maximize those strategies, it does mean less of a commitment to the local.
I want to ask both of you, when you think of broadcast history, radio and TV history, how will the Telecommunications Act of 1996 be seen in the big picture of broadcast history? If we were having this conversation 50 or more years down the road and we're looking back and it's been a good 50, 70 years.
Well, I think, and to go to your other question, too, about how much of the change that we see in the market today is the Telecom Act, I think that's really difficult to pull apart because of digitization. And that's the other thing that has really entirely disrupted these industries and would have disrupted with this act or not. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that now the technology has become cheaper and can be in the hands of individuals, and individuals now have a platform to distribute, whether it's audio or video, that piece that's added new competition to the industry and sort of changed where advertisers are going, changed where listeners are, all that was going to happen regardless. So that said, the Telecom Act in many ways was both too late and too early. Mm. Some of the main things that it was trying to respond to, it eventually came together too late to really do what they were aiming to do, and at the other side, too early to really understand the digital marketplace. And so there's been talk in the last year or so of the need for another major act to take a look at the new competitive landscape. To some degree, we've seen the FCC being really involved with these massive conglomeration deals on the television side and regulating to a degree, and also moving into the regulation of internet ownership and the net neutrality policy. And so I think all of those pieces have bigger potential 50 years from now in terms of determining the bigger landscape than Telecom 96 ever will.
And from your perspective, Dick Kernan.
As Amanda pointed out, the thing that's changing, and it's changing at a breakneck speed, is all of the additional distribution systems for audio entertainment. As she points out, you know, the podcasting, this is the prevailing view in radio, is that podcasting is the next big deal. A number of reasons for that. But the point is, I compare radio today to network television back in the early 1980s. When you got home from work, you had two or three TV stations to watch the news on, right?
Right, at a set time.
And here comes this industry with all of these, the Weather Channel, come on, the Home and Garden Channel, that'll never work. And it works. And that's going to happen to radio. Radio is going to have to look for narrower and narrower audiences that have an audience that is responsive to ads that are aimed at them. And I was so wrong. I mean, I jeered and hooted at the Home and Garden Channel. Yeah, right. People, you're going to watch people hang drywall and plant bushes. That'll be exciting.
Food
and
Network.
The Weather Channel was worse. Yeah, the Food Channel.
Yeah.
And so you can't look at these things and say, yeah, but they'll never be as big. Well, really? I think we have an interesting, I guess, example of where I think a lot of radio will go. Can I ramble on here for a minute? There's a station in Detroit called WMUZ. Have you ever heard of it?
Yeah, I started there. That was my first station.
That's the future of radio, and I don't mean the fact that it's a Christian station. I mean that I have never seen them turn up in a rating book. But I'm very familiar with the station. We have a lot of graduates who work there, and this is how they work it. They have a very, very narrow audience. But the great thing is that narrow audience never turns them off. They get up with them in the morning. They go to bed with them at night. The way that they handle their advertising is terrific. If a salesperson goes out and gets a little bit of interest, the salesperson said, I'd like to come back next week with one of our production directors. They go back the following week with, they have four production directors, and the production director asks the client two questions. Number one, what's the most important thing you want people to know about your product or your service or your store? And number two, what's your biggest problem? They go back to the station and custom make, I don't know, two or three commercials. They will not sign a contract for under 6 months. So you can't get on there for 2 weeks at a time. So they supply their advertisers with this built-in audience who hears their message all the time. They update the commercials regularly, and it works.
Interesting times, and it'll be interesting just to see how things play out. We may not be here. We may be watching from that great broadcast studio in the sky, Dick, but down the road in 50 years.
I'm going to be way ahead of you on that score. Keep in mind, I've been in the radio business 60 years. What does that tell you?
Dick Herndon, a 60-year veteran of the Detroit radio scene, who's the vice president of industry relations at the Specs Howard School of Media Arts and professor of communication studies, Amanda Lotz, with the University of Michigan. Great talking to both of you. Thank you so much.
Always
a pleasure. On Election Day, you might be tempted to share a selfie on Facebook, Snapchat, or Instagram of you with your ballot. But as of now in Michigan, if you did, you'd be breaking state law. Rick Pluta explained at our most recent Issues and Ale event in Lansing why you can't legally take a selfie with your ballot in Michigan.
There is a roughly 100-year-old Michigan law that says that you may not expose your ballot at the polling site. And the idea is, I know it sounds like really racy, but the idea was that it was an anti-corruption measure, that you wouldn't fill out your ballot and then walk past the poll watcher and show them that you did what you were expected to do. But we have a phenomenon in the age of smartphones and social media where people are, in fact, taking their pictures at the polling places, saying, I voted, showing their ballot, showing that they voted for a particular candidate that they're enthusiastic about. And these people are all, not necessarily by state law, but by an interpretation of state law, law breakers. And so the instructions that the Secretary of State sends out to local clerks right now is no one may take a picture at a polling place right now because it's a Pandora's box in terms of this. There is a lawsuit in the federal district court in Grand Rapids. There was a decision out of the first federal appellate circuit in New England that struck down New Hampshire's ballot selfie law. And there will also be probably this week State House Democrats sending a letter to Secretary of State Ruth Johnson saying, let us take ballot selfies.
That was Rick Pluta explaining why it's currently illegal to take a selfie with your ballot in Michigan. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Cass Adair, and Liz Dickey. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.